QSO Today, episode 492, Linus Balasus, LY2H. This episode of QSO Today is listener-sponsored. Only you can keep the QSO Today podcast coming to you every weekend since 2014. Please become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor banner on the show notes page or at the top of the QSOtoday.com webpage. As I am closer to episode 500, I am planning a new chapter of QSO Today with a stronger emphasis on supporting the QSO Today Academy, with the podcast and all of the video presentations that were generated from 6 QSO Today Virtual Ham Expos and 1 QSO Today Academy event. To make it even better and a real perceived threat to organizations that think that amateur radio education should be exclusive. To this end, your support by becoming a regular sponsor or any generous donation that represents the value of QSO Today to you is deeply appreciated. I am using some new but expensive AI tools to help me and the team here better organize and present this content to make it easier for you to find what you want in the medium that is most convenient and interesting to you. I will reveal it all in episode 500 coming soon. This week, I want to thank Bob Celio, N2PE, for renewing his annual listener sponsorship, and to Lenny Fagan, K9EH, for his generous donation of $180. There were anonymous donations too, and I want to express my gratitude. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, amateur call sign 4Z1UG, where I demonstrate the diversity and relevance of the amateur radio hobby and its impact on society by interviewing ham radio operators, many of whom played vital roles in shaping our technology through the amateur radio hobby. And while many people might say, "Ham radio, do people still do that?" this podcast demonstrates through in-depth interviews just how amazing, diverse, and dynamic the amateur radio hobby continues to be. A few notes before we start. I received a message this week that Bob Heil, K9EID, passed away on February 28th. Bob's contribution to amateur radio and professional sound was profound. He was my guest in episode 72, back in December of 2015, where he spoke of his early beginnings in ham radio and his professional sound career. You can find that episode by just putting in K9EID in the search box at the top of the QSOtoday.com homepage. We have a large number of English-speaking hams in Israel who hang out on WhatsApp, All-Star, and DMR. I created a talk group's webpage with a link at the top of the QSO Today website. If you'd like to join us here in Israel, please check out our All-Star node and DMR talk group. Keep in mind that we are 7 hours ahead of the East Coast and that mornings or very late evenings your time will catch us. Linus Balasus, LY2H, now hosts a YouTube channel on amateur radio, field operations, QRP, and operating CW. Growing up in Lithuania, becoming one of the country's best-known news correspondents, a member of the Lithuanian Parliament, now enjoys CW and digital modes from his ham radio van or electric bicycle in nature, operating parks, hill forts, and castles on the air. LY2H tells his ham radio story in this QSO Today. LY2H, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Linus?
4Z1UG, this is LY2 Hotel. Hello, Eric, I'm here.
It's nice to meet you, Linus. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. Can we start at the beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Thanks for having me on your show. Great show, by the way.
Thank you.
I started in, I think, more than 40 years ago, being at the age of 17, maybe too old for a young ham, but that what it was. I was in my last class of my secondary school, the last grade sort of my secondary school. So I was around 17, and that was 1978, I guess. I just somehow read a book. A tiny book about, you know, how to become a ham radio operator. It was translated into Lithuanian language, a book from, I think, from some Russian author of that time. So anyway, it was very, very, so to say, I was somehow got bitten and you know. And then I decided to join such a strange institution as it was called at that time, the Center for Young Technicians, something like that. It's the non-formal education institutions, you know, were in vogue at that time in my country. So you could join the Center of Young Technicians, the Center of Young Nationalists, nationalist, like, you know, those who enjoy nature. So I joined this center, and it was very, very useful. We were a group of maybe 15 or 20 guys and girls, about something like that. So I learned my Morse code. I got my great, great mentors like Lima Yankito, Mike Bravo. He's a silent key now, and Lima Yankito, Bravo, Bravo, Fox. At that time, our prefixes were not Lima Yankee, because, you know, you probably know that Lithuania was an occupied country by Russians of that time.
What was the hometown? Because I think we kind of want to set the setting that you are in Lithuania and you grew up in Soviet-occupied Lithuania at the time. What was your hometown?
My hometown is the capital city, Vilnius. Vilnius, capital of Lithuania. It's my native town.
Did you have an interest in technology and electronics or electrical things even before you were a high school student?
Yes, yeah. Well, I think I was, yeah. As all, you know, in my teens, I was interested in radio electronics.
What was the thing that started that? What triggered that interest?
Well, it wasn't ham radio. It was like something called crystal radio, usual stuff like, you know, you have one diet and you connect it to the heating battery, and then you can listen to some strong AM station. Then things like, you know, we called it the music of colors. You do a audio amplifier, and you put in the right filters, and you connect. You know, these filters are connected with the colored bulb, and you know the low tones were blue, and the red tones were red. And then you put a kind of a glass, you know, in front of these tubes or lamps.
You did that in high school. In American electronics courses in those days, we called those color organs.
Yeah, color organs, yeah.
You're right. They had three channels for lights. We use Christmas light bulbs, I think.
Mm-hmm.
To do the same thing, hook those to the speaker output on your stereo, and you had this magic display, which I still thought was kind of very cool. Okay, so you were building electronic devices then, even before you got into radio.
Yes, probably, yeah. So as I said, I got this ham radio bug at being 17, so probably being 15, I'm just, you know, got interested more or less in the electronics as such. My brother, he's 5 years older than me. He started first, then he dropped. So he dropped it, and I'm not. So that's how it came out.
So he dropped out of ham radio, but you stayed in. And so you went to the Center of Young Technicians, and that was also in Vilnius?
Yes, yeah, that was in Vilnius.
Was ham radio part of that program in terms of that training? Did they think that at that time that was a good direction to go?
Yes, the ham radio was part. It was actually, it was just ham radio kind of a classes. Yeah, absolutely. It was short waves and all the equipment of that time. And the equipment of that time, it was not IESO and ICOMS and Kenwoods in this part of the world. You know, it was either old military equipment or homemade equipment. So in this center, we had some marine receivers with some extra transceiverization, so to say, add-ons, like, you know, you construct your own transmitter and you synchronize the VFO with the transmitter with the VFO with the receiver, and you have a transceiver in this way. So, and the quality was pretty good of these marine receivers, and it was pretty nice. There were also some huge, weighing like 100 kilos, like 200 pounds, military receivers, R-250M, I think. Collectioneers in the West like them very much up to this very day, I guess, paying a lot of money for them. But it was also, yeah, pretty good quality of these receivers. Not maybe as good as with the Western transceivers, but still, for us at that time, it was very good. And even, you know, big club stations during the Soviet times, the club stations were very popular in Lithuania too. And it's like, you know, there was a big factory like producing some electronics, whatever. And they had a club station. This club station was very well equipped with these military receivers, with the homemade amplifiers, great antennas, you know, also homemade, but in the factory made. And stations like United Kilo 2, Bravo, 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 at that time, it was, you know, one of the strongest stations in Europe. So, and I was very much engaged in the contest in my young days. So right after I was, you know, graduating these classes at the Young Technician Center, I started visiting this one of these mega stations, UK2 BBB, and started taking part in the contests. And that was a really huge school. You know, it was like we've been working shifts, like five people sitting at five working places, the other five people sleeping, and then we're changing shifts, and we, you know, we've been taking part in the worldwide contest with the great success. So that was very good school indeed, despite all the weird equipment, you may say, you know, from the point of Western equipment of that time, but it was working very well.
You had to be a good operator to be able to win a contest with equipment that maybe wasn't necessarily state of the art.
Yes. Well, as I said, it was quite, you know, quite okay. All these receivers, they were modified with additional extra filters put in. All the unique schematics of synchronizing, you know, the multiple, if you run multi-multi, if you run not multi-multi, but you run multi-operators, single transmitter, and you have to synchronize that, you know, I push PDT and you push PDT, so we have to block who's first, you know, the other should be blocked. And that was made on some kind of a very wise relay system by the engineers who were professionals in this area. And basically, we could jump from the band to band, like I'm on 20 meters, you are on 40 meters. And we could run the multi-operator single transmitter contest on different bands without violating, you know, the rule of being not being allowed to be simultaneously on two bands. But the difference was like, you know, parts of the second. Like I push my pedal, I do a QSO on 20. Then I finish, you push your pedal, and exactly after, you know, half a second, the station signal is on 40 meter band. And sometimes, you know, the jury been thinking that, you know, oh, these guys violating the rules, they're running multi-multi instead of multi-single. No, they were, you know, all the documentation presented to them, and they said, oh, wow, that's a great, you know, very wise synchronization schematics.
But in those days, it required quite a bit of very good engineering in order to pull off multi-single operation with equipment that was highly modified for the work. I guess it required a lot of brain power expertise, it sounds to me.
Yes, as I said, you know, in these mega stations, the professional engineers, radio electronic engineers who've been working in these factories, they've been doing the job. We had one or two really brilliant constructors, professional radio electronic engineers, who've been constructing their own transceivers, like, you know, UP2 Nancy Victor, later LY2 Nancy Victor. So he was just a genius constructor. He constructed two transceivers, which are still popular still nowadays. You know, people having them, some of even constructing these transceivers anew. So, yeah, It was a lot of bright people who were, you know, devoting their time and their knowledge to construct from the. It was also difficult to get even the components and parts for these transceivers. So luckily, they were working in military factories, some of them, or this radio electronic factory, and it was easier somehow for them to get these components. Don't ask me how, I don't know, but they've been getting these components somehow.
Now, the majority of the listeners of the QSO Today podcast are in the United States or they're in other English-speaking countries. And you got your license probably at the height of the Cold War, meaning that the Soviet Union was occupying satellite countries all around it, and before it broke up at the end of the 80s. So you're kind of in the thick of it. Why do you think the Soviet Union had a large number of amateur radio operators? It seems to be that would be antithetical to the Soviets to have ham radio operators operating not only in Russia and the Soviet states, but also the occupied states like Lithuania. Why did you think they would allow that?
Well, that's a good question, but I doubt there's a good question for it. You know, it was kind of technical sports, as it was called at that time. Probably amateur radio operators were kind of a source of military servicemen who could, you know, be qualified to serve as the radio operators in the army. Probably, I don't know. I never served in the Soviet army because, you know, I joined the university, and in the university you were not obliged to go to the army if you were in the university. So I don't know how about the Russian army of that time, but maybe that's an explanation. But of course, there were some restrictions. We were not allowed to talk to certain countries like Israel, for example. Israel was considered an not friendly, if not an enemy, then non-friendly country to the Soviet Union. And, well, you know, but actually we were making contacts with the Israeli stations while nobody was, you know, tracing us so heavily. So maybe it's a bit strange because we've been living under the Iron Curtain, as you know. No free speech, no free press was available for us at that time. And then suddenly, and that was one of my, so to say, motivation why I was got this bug of ham radio. Because, you know, it was a window to a free world. Anyway, you know, I got my receiver where there was no jamming on my receiver on amateur radio bands, because on broadcast bands there was heavy jamming.
Because you had Voice of America. And
Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Vatican, everything and anything was jammed by the Soviet jamming transmitters. So amateur radio bands were not. And you could, you know, you could make contacts, you know, in Morse code or even in English with the foreign stations, you know. And there was no such a very, very sort of, it was formal recommendations not to make contacts with Israel or other stations. But, you know, it was not like if you make a contact, then you got arrested. At least not in Lithuania. Maybe somewhere in Russia, I don't know, because even if we were occupied, we were not part of Russia. We are not Russians, and we were not Russians, and this different culture. So maybe even those you know, authorities of that time, they were also Lithuanian communists, and they were not Russians, and so maybe they were not also a bit more.
After you got your first license, did you have your own home station?
Yes.
What was your first rig?
I did have my own station, and my first, you had to be for 1 year a shortwave listener. First, you get the license of a listener at that time. It's the same actually now. Then I had my first radio receiver. It's a direct conversion, three transistors based receiver. Absolutely fantastic receiver. I think I will make a video, you know, sometime in the future. I will construct it again because it was working so nicely that with the long wire, I've been living in the city center of that at that time. So it's a bit in the low place. And I've been, you know, amazed on 20 meters for three band, 48 and 20, 84 and 20 meter bands. On 20 meters in the morning, I've been receiving, you know, South America. And I've been, you know, waking up 2 hours earlier than I need to for my, you know, before I went to the school, just to listen and, you know, copy and, you know, to make the law, because you had to have some, I don't know how many, these SYL shortwave listeners' contacts locked into your log, which you should, you know, get confirmed by the other station. That was not that easy. So, and I remember I was just, you know, excited. I came to my school and said to my, you know, classmate, listen, you know what I heard this morning? Guadalupe. Wow. That was, you know, that was, for me, it was something. So, and then when I... pass the exams, you're getting the lowest category class. I don't know, that was categories in numbers. Number three was the lowest category. It was limited to 10 watts of output, and the bands were limited, I think, for 80, 40, and 10 meter bands, something like that. So I had my first transmitter. It was two transistors and one tube. Very nice transmitter, 10 watts exactly. And I had kind of a old Russian military receiver. I think it was originally used in a tank. So it was pretty tiny, you know, because in the tank probably they would be making smaller things. So it was pretty tiny receiver. And so that was my first station, and it was very working very nice. I've been doing, you know, the tube type transmitter is just a dream. You don't need to care about SWR, and you know, you can tune with the final stage of the tube type amplifier anything and everything. It was not 50 ohms world yet, so you see.
And you were operating CW.
Yes, that was pure CW. Yes, I didn't have I think the anything SSB since 3 or 4 years, because, you know, I've been running this. Then I upgraded my class, my operator's class, to class 2. Then that meant more bands and 40 watts of power. And then at that time, I already bought secondhand something like homemade transceiver. So it was, yeah, it was okay. It was all bands, 5 bands over that time. It was SSB, and well, that was a day and night compared to this my CW first station. But still, anyway, that was yeah. Then I upgraded to the first category, and then it was like, you know, one transceiver, the other transceiver. I've been constructing QRP, my own things, and something like that. So, being a ham radio operator in these times, it meant you had to be a constructor. A constructor too, because, you know, you couldn't buy anything manufacturer made. Later on, in some late 80s, like 1989, 1990, you could buy something very primitive transceivers manufacturer made by some Soviet factories, but all these homemade transceivers which we were using, they were much, much better, because, you know, they were constructed by professional engineers, ham operators, and the specs they've been having, as I said, this Lithuanian transceiver, it's been having crystal filter, eight pole crystal filter. The dynamic range was 90 dBs, so that was really good equipment. So all these Russian manufacturer made, they were just a crap compared to these. So nobody been buying.
And now this break. The QSO Today project that includes this podcast and the QSO Today Academy is now listener sponsored. There are no commercial sponsors to influence the content and opinions expressed on QSO Today, including my blog posts. Disclaimer: we did not have a problem with sponsor influence when we did have commercial sponsors. The world is different now. I believe that commercial sponsorship, where you watch and listen to TV, radio, YouTube, Facebook, and X for free, does give sponsors complete control over all that you see and hear. The largest networks are now dominated by international corporations who decide in their boardrooms what we hear, know about, how we vote, and what we buy. Commercial sponsorship models for podcasts don't work, maybe for good reasons. At QSO Today, we are back to blogging and podcasting for the free expression of ideas, discussion, and the dissemination of content without commercial sponsorship. It takes everyone's ideas and approaches in our discussions to formulate our own way with the best information available. This has always been the best formula for success, even in ham radio. So QSO Today is now value for value, following the model created by another ham, Adam Curry, K5AAC, inventor of podcasting and the value for value business model. I create valuable amateur radio content that you consume. In return, you find it valuable, then you reward the podcast with your sponsorships, donations, transcription sponsorships, and using the QSO Today Amazon link. Your supporting the podcast in this way keeps QSO Today podcasts coming to you every week since July of 2014, now approaching 500 episodes. In addition, we have over 500 educational ham radio videos from previous QSO Today virtual ham expos that we also publish to allow every ham to benefit from these excellent presentations. However, all of this content has to be produced, edited, curated, and hosted on commercial platforms by me and my team to keep it easily accessible and available to you. Links and banners on the show notes pages allow you to show your support of the QSO Today project. Please support QSO Today with your sponsorships, donations, and using our Amazon links. And now back to our QSO Today. Did Perestroika, the crumbling of the Iron Curtain, did that kind of open up Lithuania to the purchase of other manufacturers? I mean, obviously, I see behind you now ICOM, some Elecraft, some Yaesu. Did it change the world for ham radio operators then?
Oh, yes. Yes, of course. Surely it did. When we regained our independence in 1990, 11th of March. So, of course, we've become a free country, completely free. We've become so in 1991 after all these fights and the tragic events. You know, we were attacked by Russians in 1991, and they used a brutal military force. And there were people killed, but after that, we finally liberated ourselves, and we started free life, of course. You could buy then from the West whatever you wanted, actually, but practically it wasn't that easy. You know, there were no dealers like, you know, in your country where you can, you know, you should buy it abroad, and the prices were, you know, cosmic prices for that time, because, you know, the living standards were pretty low still, you know, in the beginning, just in the beginning of recreating a state, actually, you know, economics, industries, businesses, everything, law system. So these were crazy times, you know. It's not it was not the first task, you know, on where to buy transceiver from. It was just, you know, how to build your state anew. There were people importing goods, and you could buy things, and
You finished at the Center for Young Technicians, but did you go on then to university as well?
Yes, I entered the university. And I chose to study journalism. So nothing technical at all. It's just pure humanity. But before joining the Vilnius University, I was actually joining the Kaunas, the second largest city, the technical university. Because I was thinking that I want to become a radio engineer. So, and I was starting preparing myself, and I was, you know, almost started, you know, passing the exams. But then suddenly, somehow, you know, I was from the big city. Vilnius is a big city, and the Kaunas is a smaller city. And I started feeling not good being a kid of a big city in the in this smaller city. It's second largest city, but it for me it was kind of, you know, a bit too provincial. I was missing my friends and the atmosphere of the big town. And, you know, and I was, you know, always kind of a dualism in me between the technician and humanitarian. And finally, I made my mind up that, you know, I know, okay, the hobby must can be a hobby. And then I decided I come back to Vilnius and I joined the university and you know, the journalism studies. And I did successfully. It was not that easy. It was a big competition, but I somehow managed to squeeze in being the number 30, probably out of 30. So anyway, lucky me. So, and then we had a good and strong club station in the university. And there were all the bright people, professors, you know, professors of physics and other economists and whatever. Very bright people, all ham radio and students too. And we had a fantastic team there. And we've been, you know, going this innovative route, like, you know, we were actually the first in Lithuania starting the digital modes of that time. That was RTTY, or people, sometimes I hear people saying RIDI in America. So we started RIDI in a mechanical form of it. So you know what it is?
Sure. Model 19, Model 14. Yeah, all these old teletypes is what I remember as a kid.
Yeah, yes. There was no computer screens. It was just the rolling tape of paper and, you know, and printer and printing out. That was amazing. So, and then we also were one of the first who started the meteor scatters and the moon bounce contacts. We've been driving away from town. There was a kind of a, I don't know, kind of a base of the university somewhere in the good quiet fields, you know. So we've been doing meteor scatters. So, and the meteor scatters of that time also was not like now, you know, you got a WJT software and you have the meteor scatters if you wish, you know, not the case. So you should, you know, use the magnetic tape recorders with the, you know, speeding up, slowing down, and oh my God. So we've been doing all that, and it was so amazing and so, you know, kind of a progressive. It's not like, you know, doing CW or SSB contacts. It was kind of a, you know, the whole theory behind that. We had discussions because the guys, mentors, teachers, they were all professors of physics, most of them, you know, or very well-educated technicians, engineers. So for me, it was kind of a... I dropped my Kaunasi Technical University, you know, for journalism studies, but I gained what I dropped, you know, in this club station of the university. So that's my kind of a technical background comes actually from these 5 years of studying the master's degree in journalism, but I also, you know, got some kind of junior bachelor studies indirectly by being member of this university ham radio club.
Well, it seems to me that anybody that Googles your name, there are dozens of articles that come up, mostly in Russian and Lithuanian. There are dozens of pictures that come up, you as a young man all the way through your career. It seems to me that you became a very important news correspondent in Lithuania and had a pretty long career. I'm assuming maybe you're close to retirement or maybe you're retired now. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I'm a professional journalist. So, and my now I'm not retired yet, but I'm kind of a self-employed. I do some consulting, but being economically independent, I have no need to work, you know, for a living. Actually, lucky me.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. I do some consulting, yeah, I do some writing, but most of my time I'm devoting to my YouTube channel, which is monetized and that doesn't bring, you know, no money at all, actually, but that's some, you know, a very small one. But anyway, yes, I've been a journalist, and my, so to say, major fields of my interest always were, since, like, 30 years, European Union, NATO, defense policies, and all these things. If getting back a little bit, just my after the university years, when I started work as a journalist, being yet a student, so still in the Soviet times, and I my first job, actually first and the only job, was the National Radio and Television, and I was working in the radio department, and I was a journalist at the so-called Radio Vilnius Foreign Service. That was kind of a strange institution, but in this institution, we were preparing programs about, the life in Lithuania for the foreign listeners, for the diaspora abroad in Lithuanian, and for the general world in English. And that was, maybe you can call it, it was a propaganda station, but actually, paradoxically, it was a far less censorship than for the domestic broadcasters of that time. So I was, feeling pretty free, to show things which were not allowed to show on screen or talk on the radio. For local journalists, for me as a broadcaster for abroad, I was allowed to show to many more things. So from there, from these years, like it was four or five years, I think, I got my interest in all this, international politics, because I was able, to speak about that more freely. So then, during the independence years, I've been doing all the biggest talk debate shows on the domestic television, because then I switched from radio to television, and the last 30 years were spent like a TV personality and journalist. So, and then since 1997, I started making programs, devoted to international politics, NATO, European Union. Then in 2002, skipping some 20 years forward winding, but because all these 20 years I've been working in Lithuania in the national television as a anchor and author and producer of all these, programs about EU, NATO, and international politics. And then I was the first correspondent of Lithuania in Brussels. Lithuania was entering European Union and NATO in this decade. And it was the final stage of entering, like 2000, 2002, 2004, the year of entrance. So starting from 2002, I convinced my bosses and the politicians who were in power that, we need to find financing and to establish a correspondence office in Brussels, because it was so important, to be there at this very important moment for your country when you're joining NATO and you're joining European Union, especially because there were 10 years of negotiations between EU and Lithuania, on which conditions you joined the Union. And it was so important to have your media and press to cover objectively what's going on in Brussels, because, politicians, they try to manipulate. So I spent very, very happy, actually 8 years in Brussels. And so that's why my Belgian call sign is Oscar Nancy 4 Bravo Hotel Papa. So, I was also active as a Belgian amateur, being living and working in Brussels. And somehow, paradoxically, I got a Belgian call sign, not the foreigner living in Belgium, which I should have been Oscar Nancy 6 or Oscar Nancy 7, I guess. But I don't know why, but they just issued, because my Lithuanian call sign.
They considered you a landsman.
I don't know. My Lithuanian call sign was LY2 Bravo Hotel Papa at that time. I didn't have this LWA to hotel yet. My another call sign is Lima Yankee to Bravo Hotel Papa. And somehow the guy sitting in this Belgian communication office, they saw that my license is LY2BHP, and they offered, so maybe you want Oscar Nancy 4BHP. I said, yeah, sure, of course. It's a Belgian call sign, very nice. So, and I was active, I was very busy as a journalist, as you can imagine, been traveling around Europe or so, and United States half of the world, Afghanistan, and all these things. But I was also finding some time, to be active as a Belgian operator. And so I've been actually taking part in every field day and winning Belgian first places in the field days and the contests and so that was very, very happy years in Brussels, both professionally and as a ham radio. So that was very, very nice.
It's my understanding you also spent some years in the Lithuanian parliament, right? Two terms, did you say?
Yes, I've spent two terms as a kind of a independent member of parliament, I would say. I was elected. We have a mixed election system. Part of the MPs are elected under the list, and the part is elected directly in the constituency. So I was one of those elected directly in the constituency. So in two consecutive years, so terms, so it's eight years. Before I joined the parliament, almost 3 years of my career, I was the chief advisor for the president of the country. So we had a president, Madam Grybauskaitė. So it was since 2009 till 11, I was the chief advisor for the president, but then I quit and I went my own political way. So that's actually 10 full years in full politics, first as an advisor, shadow politician, and then directly politician.
From what I can see, you were awarded three national awards for being a correspondent, but also for being in politics.
Yeah.
Can you say what those awards are and what they were for?
Yeah, I think mainly probably for all these years I've been working as a journalist, and my contribution, which I don't think it was that huge a contribution, really. I've just been doing my job. But, well, it said that, for my merits for the country in, getting the country into a democratic unions and whatever, so something like that.
You're very modest. We have kind of a motto here in Israel, the secret of success in Israel is showing up.
Maybe it's a universal, so to say, kind of a story. But for me, I like to do what I like, and I do what I like. I like to speak what I think, and that's it. And I don't care, too much what other people think about me, whether I am wrong, maybe I'm not. So I'm very glad that and I hope there is some contribution of mine. That, we have a free speech, finally, we may have good journalists, bad journalists, corrupt journalists, biased journalists, but we have a free speech. And according to the index of free speech, Lithuania is pretty, pretty high. I think number 7 in the world or in Europe, something like that. Comparing to where we started, it was like, maybe 110 or something like that, just right post-Soviet democracy. So we did a huge step forward, and now when you see really the full democracy is just booming.
Well, it sounds to me like that's a feather in your cap, and you played a big part in that turnaround. Let's shift gears now. One of the reasons that we're talking is because somebody had sent me a YouTube clip of one of the ham radio YouTube episodes that you're making on your YouTube channel. the production value, I'm promoting Linus now, is the production value on his YouTube channel is absolutely amazing. It seems to me that the time, in terms of the amount of time that you spend on each episode, is just perfect. So it's enough to educate, but not too much to put you to sleep. It's really amazing, and I'm hoping that listeners will go and see your YouTube channel if they haven't already. But anyway, how did you start the YouTube channel, and when did you start it?
Well, I started my YouTube channel, I think, 2 years ago. It's a third year, actually. 2024 is a third year. So my first video came out, I think, in 2021. In all this difficult situation of COVID isolation and restrictions, I had a bit more time because, you know, I wasn't in the parliament anymore. So, and I had a bit more time, and so that I decided, you know, why don't I, you know, do what I like and what I like to do all the time, because, you know, it's my profession. I'm a TV professional, so that's nothing new to me to make videos. I've been doing it all my time, basically all my career for the last 27 years. But the possibilities and the equipment and the possibilities to make the production, it's so different even from what I been doing like 15 or 20 years ago in Brussels. We had a state-of-the-art equipment in Brussels for that time, but still we were not fully digital. Like, you know, we were semi-digital cameras, semi-digital editing unit. You know, it was very good, top class of that time, but not my Final Cut or my Luma Fusion editing program, which I have now on my iPad. And I always wanted, you know, to film with my phone or portable camera because, you know, my professional camera, by the way, my wife is a TV director and she was working as a camera woman, so camera operator. And she's been carrying this 11 kilos, you know, camera, and she's pretty small one. So I always wanted, you know, to be able to film with a small camera or with your iPhone, as I do now, and film yourself, you know, talk yourself, edit yourself, do the voiceover, whatever you want. And so that was I wanted to do all my life in the professional career. But, you know, unfortunately, I quit my TV job before this capability was possible. So, and now suddenly I found myself, you know, I have more time. I have my iPhone. I have my iPad, you know, with the good processor in it. And I can do all this. So I decided, let's go. So I you know, made my YouTube channel, you know, more active. Like, you know, I started doing it and that's it. And you know, and I thought I have, okay, more than 40 years of experience as a ham radio. I know something, I think, you know, I'm interested very much in antennas, you know, in all this, you know, creating antennas, calculating antennas, you know, measuring antennas and QRP also. So it's a very good food and gymnastic for your brain to try to create an antenna and calculate, you know, it, you know, it's a very, very healthy in the aging society, you know, it's a good practice for your brain to keep it, you know, still on some certain level of your cognitive abilities.
I believe so.
So I decided that why don't I do these videos, and I started, and slowly, kind of a step by step, I started, you know, gaining subscribers, and the big event was first 1,000 of subscribers, you know, then you can monetize. I did, but as I said, it doesn't bring in much profits. Well, probably it covers my, some, you know,
your gas
or electricity costs, you know, or gas for my radio van, you know, because I bought a tiny camper, and I called it my radio van because, you know, it's designed for my radio trips, so to say, for my outdoorsy activities, and that's very fun.
Before we get to the van, though, I just want to ask you, are you making the videos using your iPhone, or are you using a small camera or something like that? Because the quality is very good.
I'm using my old iPhone, actually. It's an iPhone Max Pro 11, but it's still running very well. I see no need to replace it with anything new. And I have my GoPro 9. Which is very nice little camera, but so sometimes I use two cameras, sometimes I use one of them. It depends. But I was surprised by the quality of iPhone, actually, because I have a remote microphone if I need, but I don't use it in most cases because the iPhone's microphone is so amazingly smart that you can, if you zoom in the video, it zooms in the sound too. So that's crazy. And I discovered that feature, and it, you can film a bird sitting in the tree and singing. And if you zoom in onto the tree, somehow the filters in the iPhone, zooms in the sound too. It's like you've come closer to the bird and you start hearing just this bird and you don't hear the hum.
That's pretty amazing. Yes. Yes, it is.
Very nice. So that's very nice. iPhone is very good, so to say, phone for filming. And I know very many YouTubers use iPhones because there are people even creating films, all the fiction films with iPhones mainly.
I think the first movie I saw where they use an iPhone for recording the movie was about a singer who was a sensation in South Africa named Sexto Rodriguez.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see that? That was all done on an iPhone 4, apparently.
Yes.
That was quite amazing that you could actually pull off a major feature using an iPhone. Let's switch to the van a bit. I actually, in preparing for this interview, I was going through all your YouTube videos looking for the interior of the van because you call it your radio van, and yet the operating position is in the passenger side of the front cab looking out the window. And I thought, well, maybe the radio van would have a bench in it and all kinds of stuff. And it, on the one hand, on the other hand, I felt, well, you know what, if you're operating and you have this beautiful view because you're in a park or on top of a mountain or something like that, you should be looking out the window at the same time that you're operating. What's in the van?
Yes, it's a tiny van. It's a Renault Traffic, shortened and heightened. So it's a Renault Traffic and the year 2009, I guess. So pretty old one. Diesel engine, and it's converted into a camper van. I didn't do it myself. I partially did, but I bought it with all this interior done, all these closets and whatever and everything. I only remade all the electricity, all the electrical part. I installed the two solar batteries on top. So 200 watts solar batteries on top. I installed all these, the camper batteries and all these, all things I need to my ham radio things, the 12 volt grid and everything like that. And it's a good, it's enough of place, for two people to travel and a tiny dog. We used to have a tiny dog. Unfortunately, we don't have it anymore. Maybe we'll have another one in some time in the future. But it's good for three persons, two humans and one four-legged friend. And it's enough. I have a bench, but this bench, is installed in the front seat of in the passenger side of the seat. If I need to, I can. Sometimes I operate also in the living area. But if we travel, my wife and me, so then I don't want to take space for my radio. From the general living space. So that's why I made a tiny bench in the front seat, and it's basically enough for my QRO operation. QRO, 100 watts, not this QRO, 1 kilowatt. But It's solar panels. I got a big battery, not really that big, but 130 amp hours battery. It's still a lead acid battery because when I was making it like maybe 4 years ago, I found a good price for this lead acid battery. It's also a deep discharge lead acid battery, but not yet lithium ferrum life power, not lithium battery basically yet. So maybe in the future I will replace it with a LiFePO4 battery. But anyway, normally I'm activating parks with my camper van. And before the COVID started, I activated like in 1 year, like 40 parks. In Lithuania, as in most European countries, we have the worldwide flora fauna program, somehow more popular than the POTA program. So there are some POTA operators too, but not so many activities. So I'm more frequently I operate the WWFF, because more European operators coming, just huge pileups when you go somewhere into a park. That's very fun, you know, parks activation, SOTA too, but we don't have mountains in Lithuania, so no SOTA for me, but parks, yes.
You say on your YouTube introduction, you do parks, summits, and castles.
Yes, castles, yes.
Is there a Castles on the Air program in Lithuania or in Europe?
Yes, not that popular, but castles. Kind of a branch of the castles program. We have quite popular national program of Hill Fort award. You know what the Hill Fort is?
No.
It's kind of a castle on a hill, like a fortification installation, something like that. So it's pretty ancient, like, you know, 12th century, 13th century. The whole country of Lithuania, land of Lithuania of that time, was full of these hills, artificially made sometimes, and forts, fortification on these hills. So that's why they called hill forts. And it was due to, you know, to create the kind of a protection system for the country, like, you know, enemies been attacking us from all around the exterior countries. So we've been defending ourselves in building numerous these hills and the small forts, and these small forts were also used by the, you know, knights when they've been traveling. They need to have a kind of a possibility, you know, to park somewhere with their horses, like every like maybe 100 kilometers. So that's why we have a lot of these hills with these fortifications. Some of these hills there's no fortifications anymore. They just ruined and disappeared. But the archaeologists finding them out anyway, and so that's we ham radio operators like to go to these hills, onto these hills, and activate. Very often, these hills are part of the park, also, and so it's kind of a dual or even triple award, like. Could be a castle still, if there are some castle remnants staying there. It could be a park, and it could be a hill fort. So that's. But anyway, that outdoorsy, you know, activity is so, it's so good. It's so educational. It's so healthy. You know, you just spend a day in the open. Even if you sit in a van, it's still you are in the nature. Very often, I come with a van, park somewhere, and I take my equipment and I go just, you know, do hiking or just sitting in the forest. And so that's why.
And now this mid-show break. Every 2 weeks, I listen to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast with George, KJ6VU, Vince, VE6LK, Mark, N6MTS, Thomas, K4SWL, Michael, VA3MW, and Rod, VA3ON, and their guest on often topical and important projects in amateur radio. This discussion amongst the regulars and their guests remind me of the conversations that I used to listen to on 146.94 and 146.46 megahertz in Orange County, California, while working on my own workbench almost 50 years ago. It is amazing how much practical ham radio knowledge that we can absorb by listening to the Workbench podcast that starts to make sense when we start our own deep dive into our own projects. So join me by listening to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast now and as George and crew push beyond 200 episodes. You can get to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast by clicking on the banner in this week's show notes page. And now, back to our QSO. Linus, what's your favorite operating mode when you're out there in the nature?
CW, 100%. I'm a CW, so to say, fan. I like also operating SSB. Why not? Because you're getting much more operators, you're getting much more correspondence, and you give your park for many more hunters who want, you know, just to get this park. And very often they are SSB people. But also a huge pileups in CW still, which I'm very glad, you know, of that. Still very many people know CW. And what is even more amazing, more and more people start learning and you, the Morse code, you know, somehow, you know, you see a lot of YouTube videos on how to learn the Morse code, blah, blah, blah. And a lot of low speed operators, you know, activating parks also. And, you know, just, I'm amazed. I like it. I love CW. So CW, then the digital modes. I like digital modes. I'm a fan of FT8. Guys who are enemies of FT8, please don't listen to this part of this podcast, because, you know, I love FT8 because it's an innovation. You remember I've been speaking about my university, yes. So that's a strive for innovation, for something new. And amateur radio is the best area of getting something new and some, you know, new technological innovations in the ham radio. It's something amazing. So the FT8 is the latest and greatest digital mode, but then RTTY already is my second favorite digital mode, because it's, you know, it's just great, kind of a mixture of CW in the way you operate. You can't decode the RTTY, but the whole operation, so to say, the dynamics, I like taking part in the RTTY contests. Just did it recently with my QMX transceiver. So
that's a new QRP Labs transceiver, right? That does digital modes and RTTY?
Yes. Yeah, it does all FSK modes, all frequency shift keying modes, RTTY one of them. So it does. So I tested in one of the RTTY contests, and now I'm editing a short video about that. You know, it's still undercooked. It's every day the new upgrade in firmware comes out, but that's a great, you know, QRP Labs is a great company, and Hans G0 UPL is a great man. You know, he's running one man company
from his attic in Turkey.
Yes, he is based in Turkey. Well, he used to be based in Japan anyway, but whatever he's based, he's doing a great job. And that's also an innovation. You know, could you imagine even, you know, some 15 years ago, full SDR of that size, like QMX or QDX or QCX or whatever, fully digital technology, like, you know, your radio is just grabbing signals from the ear and decoding it with you know, just digitally by the means of the processor. That's how can you not love digital? I don't understand this, you know. So, okay, people complaining, oh, this FT8 is not real ham radio, it's not a real QSO, the robots making contacts between. Okay, you may use a software which makes software between a software. But I'm personally don't like it. I like, you know, to watch the waterfall myself, to choose the station myself, and, you know, to see what the signal evaluation is, you know, myself. And, well, if somebody likes, you know, to do it computer with computer, okay, that's also innovation in ham radio. So why not? Or the satellites.
Linus, you're going to find that the listeners of QSO today have a very open mind and know that ham radio is a huge circus of all kinds of events, all kinds of operating modes and stuff.
Absolutely.
Right, and that's what it is. Just a reminder for the listeners, Hans Sommers, G0UPL, was my guest in episode 125 some years ago. So if Perfect. You want to go back to that episode, you can. We're getting close to episode 500. So I think that was 2016, the end of 2016 when I interviewed Hans. Yes, I would agree that it's one of the most innovative companies. I have a bunch of QRP Labs kits in my drawer ready to be assembled. And now I must say I'm going to have to get a QMX as well to put in my drawer and ultimately assemble them.
Yeah, highly recommend. Highly recommend. It's going to be SSD.
By the way, and you have great videos on your use of these in the field. So I think that's another reason to tune into your YouTube channel. One of the things I was kind of intrigued by was you were operating satellites from your yard at your home. What's your favorite portable rig to use when operating satellites in the field?
At the moment, it's ICOM IC705, but it's not really a satellite dedicated rig because it doesn't have full duplex. So probably for these simple FM satellites like SO50 and a bunch of others, maybe some dedicated full duplex rigs are maybe better. I can't recall the name of these FM radios, but if you Google for full duplex rigs, dual band duplex rigs, you may find out something. But ICOM IC705 is just one of my favorite portable radios anyway, because it's also from the field of innovation. It's an amazing radio, and well, it can do the satellites work too, because to do the QSO via the satellite, this low orbit satellite, LEO satellite, you don't need full duplex. You can do it with programming memories. You can do it even with your even with your cheap walkie-talkie. That's the talk pod, which I was sent by the company to make a review. So no problems to make a contact through the LEO satellite, with anything FM dual band, but my favorite is ICOM IC705, and my favorite FT817. That's a legendary. I've just made a video, it's still getting a lot of clicks, which I'm surprised. I was surprised that so many people, are nostalgic about this rig. And I think I have more than 5,000 clicks in 2 weeks. So that's, for me, it's a lot.
That radio is also, for the microwave operators, it was a great baseband rig for 10 gigahertz.
Yes. Now, ICOM IC705 could be a full replacement, even more successful replacement than that. But still, if you can come by, it's out of production. It's not produced anymore. The FT817 and FT818, the production was quit, I think, a few years ago. But they're still, you can buy them on rallies somewhere, and
they seem to hold their value. Yeah, it's kind of amazing.
They hold their value, and still you can buy it probably for, I don't know, $400 or something like that. And it's still much cheaper than ICOM IC705. But of course, ICOM IC705 is totally different radio. It's full digital and fully digital. The quality and the specs are much, much better. You can do so many things with it that I'm not yet, studied them all. All these digital DMR things and whatever. So, but GPS, built-in GPS, and the built-in Wi-Fi connection ability. I've done a few videos about that, on how to use the your mobile Android phone for mobile field FT8 together with the ICOM IC705.
Oh, because of the Bluetooth connection between the two radios.
Yeah. Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, actually Wi-Fi, but it's amazing radio. So ICOM did it very well.
Can I ask you, do you have a ham radio workbench?
Yes, of course. Yes. One's in the garage, the other is just right here. I don't know if I could show it, but so I'm sitting just right here. So that's all on my that's my workbench here.
Do you have test equipment?
Oh yes, I have my test equipment. I have not that big equipment that I would need a rack, but I have NanoVNA. I have tiny assay, the spectrum analyzer. I have a tiny oscilloscope, digital oscilloscope, not one of these huge ones which we had in our university lab, you know. So everything's, measuring equipment, it's another amazing fact that, you can't, avoid not to be a constructor with so many cheap, good quality, good enough measuring equipment nowadays, which we have, that it's, take NanoVNA. You can do everything with it. Measure your antenna, use it as a signal generator. Use it, all these Smith chart things. One of most mysterious things is a Smith chart, but with NanoVNA, it's easier to understand it. Measure your filters. It was not just possible even 10 years ago. There was no NanoVNAs. All this equipment was a realm of the professionals. Spectrum analyzer was a something big like that and costing like $20,000. Now tiny assay costs, I don't know, $90 probably, something like that. The same as vector network analyzers. It costs like $100, and you get a very, very good piece of equipment and precise enough. So we live in a world of just fantastic to be a ham radio operator in these times.
It's more amazing now than it was. I'm one of these guys that actually has a Hewlett-Packard service monitor on my bench, but you have to be a young man to pull that thing off the bench because of its 40-pound, 50-pound weight.
Oh yeah.
I'm with you. All this nano stuff looks like it's the right stuff for the 2020 version of your workbench. What project do you have on your workbench right now?
Yeah, right now the QMX, I finished it and I'm just, I'm testing it. I'm testing it. Yeah, so that's that one project. The other project, I'm still mingling with the another SDR, the so-called true SDR, true SDX or true SDR. Another tiny radio, purely SDR, and I'm comparing them. This SDR with the QMX with QDX, and I've done some videos before, about this true SDX, but I'm just, still mingling with them, trying, to do something new. And well, just yesterday I had to repair my wife's tablet, to replace the micro USB charging port. So that's what also being a ham, you could be useful for the humanity too. Like, fixing your wife's tablet. And so I did it. I did it. It took the hot air station, to replace it and the whole arrangements to do this tiny job. But I mean, yeah, I did it. I'm very proud of myself. And my wife is happy.
And happy wife, happy life.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If there's nothing anyone learns from the QSO Today podcast, is happy wife, happy life.
Absolutely.
And then you can do whatever you want in ham radio, I've discovered.
And I must pay the tribute to my wife. She's very tolerant regarding my hobby. She is even qualified enough, to keep a counter rope when I put up a mast. She knows, how to professionally keep the rope, the counter rope, in order to keep the mast straight. And she's a great helping hand when I'm out at sea together with her. So,
And it's nice time out in nature together. Yeah, exactly right.
absolutely, yes, absolutely, yeah.
How are hams in Lithuania attracting new hams to the hobby? Is that a problem there, like it is everywhere else?
It is a problem, yes. We are an aging hobby. Maybe not that tragically as sometimes we say or we think, but yes, the average age of ham radio operator in Lithuania is probably 55, I would say, something like that. Okay, not luckily 75, but we have some young operators. Unfortunately, there is no this young technician center anymore, and there is non-formal system of non-formal education still active in Lithuania, in Lithuanian educational system, but not so many somehow ham radio operators coming to these classes. And actually, but what is good, the grandsons and granddaughters and sons and daughters of younger ham radio operators, they're taking over from their granddads and their parents and their dads and their mothers. And so we have a bunch of young operators, you know, like starting from 16 and then up to 25, 27, you know, the young generation, and they are pretty active. And we have some young professionals who are, you know, having good jobs, they have money to buy equipment. So we have some, you know, new influx of young, sort of fresh blood, not at the extent we would like to, but still, you know, still we have some. And they like to take part in the contests. They like, you know, they like to do digital, and they like satellites, and they like, you know, things even remotely connected with the ham hobby, like, you know, tracing and hunting for these hot air meteorological balloons, you know?
Right, sure.
Yeah. So the things like, you know, meteorologists, they launch a kind of a hot air zoned. Is that the right one?
Yeah, in America, they launch them twice a day, I learned, from most major airports.
Yeah. The same's here. And they've got, you know, on board some kind of a transmitters and beacons. And when they quit, they go to the stratosphere, they blew up, and they fall down. When they fall down, the hams, you know, locating them, and then they go hunt on them. You don't need to be a ham. No ham license required for that. But it's also part of the hobby of some of ham radio operators, of younger ham radio operators in Lithuania. So that's fine. Fox hunting or you know what the fox hunting is?
Sure.
The RDF, I think. Amateur radio direct finding.
We also call it tea hunting.
Yeah.
Right. Fox hunting or tea hunting.
Yeah, so the fox hunting traditionally is a strong branch, so it's still alive, and still there is some activity.
Can I ask you, Linus, it seems to me that there's a lot of non-hams in Europe that compete in Morse code sending and receiving.
It used to be quite popular in the Soviet times, but not anymore, I think, because in Soviet times, it was kind of with this... kind of a technical or military sort of sports, technical military sports. So one of these sports was this Morse code sending and receiving, speed telegraphy, or whatever you called it.
Fantastic speeds, like over 100 words a minute.
Yeah, and that was the case. And even in my times, I remember there were people, you know, training in these street key. They've been doing incredible speeds on a street key. I still can't imagine how that is possible at all. You know, I can copy quite, you know, I don't know, maybe 40 words per minute, but I can't send me with a straight key, you know, more than maybe, you know, 18 or 20. It's not just physically, it's not possible. I can do it on a key or on the keypad, but so. And these people have been trained, you know, with their wrist getting kind of a, and then, I don't know, something wrong with their wrist, you know, being able to do that speed. So this was kind of a, and these sportsmen, they were kind of a a pool for the military servicemen to go into the kind of a of that time military service in the radio communication area, probably. But since we become independent, after a few years, it ceased to exist basically because it's, I don't know, it's not that much fun. Just, you know, I understand that this is just kind of a next to incredible to be able to copy and to send such amounts and such speeds, you know.
But it's no longer a popular sport.
It's pretty boring, you know. It's pretty boring, and maybe somewhere in Russia they still have this as a sport, you know, activity, but not here anymore. I think there are maybe even European championships in this area. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Maybe there are, but not anymore here.
What excites you the most about what's happening in ham radio now?
What excites me? Oh.
That's a hard question because it seems to me that almost everything excites you, but is there one thing?
Technical progress, innovation—that's for sure. You know, when I learned, you know, what the SDR is, when it just appeared, you know, just pure SDR. You know, we have DSP thing for ages now, for more maybe for 30 years. You know, you can find the first DSP based transceivers, but just the pure software-defined radio. It's when the radio, you know, grabs all the signals of the world into your tiny QMX, and directly from this chaos and cacophony, it somehow, by the means of, you know, binary, you know, calculating in the processor somewhere, you get a audio, you get a Morse code or whatever, or digital or voice or whatever. And that is very difficult to understand. How is that on Earth is possible? And it's all getting, you know, smaller and smaller. Nanotechnology is getting into the computer, meaning into the computers, in computers getting into our radios. And now when you see that, you know, what kind of processor is in the QMX, it's a powerful processor. And in big SDR radios, even more powerful, and it's getting more and more powerful, and it's getting more and more, you know, software defined with more and more possibilities. And the only thing I'm, you know, regret that I'm not able to fully understand at some level anymore what's going on. You know, I like to read. I read a lot, but not being even a professional engineer. For me, it attracts me, but you know, it's very difficult to understand. So, but anyway, the fact itself that I realize it's going on in ham radio, and that ham radio is kind of a testing field for new technologies, and there are people, us ham radio operators, who use it for things like, you know, like you know, for our establishing a contact between us. Using these technologies, so this is really very excites me. Another thing which excites me, that's the social side of ham radio. So it's like, you know, in disasters, in emergency situations, we ham radio operators, and especially operators in America, in United States, you guys know better than me, you know, how to work in the emergency situation, earthquakes, hurricanes, whatever. I would say wars. You know, we have a war in Europe now, in Ukraine. And, well, there's no actually ham radio activity in Ukraine. Now they are recovering, but still, we ham radios, we show solidarity. You know, I bear the Ukrainian flag on my channel cap. But never mind. But I mean, it's a social side, and the being useful in the times of hardship. By the way, in the year 1991, we ham radio operators played a big role in Lithuanian revolution. But, you know, remember I said that, you know, we were attacked by Russians in 1991, and they've been the tanks in the streets. They've been killing people, 14 people dead. And at that time, there was a ham radio station in the Parliament's building. And this radio, ham radio station, the ham radio operator has been working there. And I was working as a journalist in the street at that time. But the other hams been sitting in this radio station and have been transmitting to a free world what's going on in Lithuania, because the Moscow cut all the official communication means. You know, there was no phones, there was no satellites, nothing. They cut it off. And the ham radio waves were the only means we could get in touch with another ham radio operators in Germany, in America, by the way, in other countries. And these hams been relaying this information to a local press. And that was a huge thing, you know, to get an information on what's really going on here. So that's, since then, you know, it's my experience. What's the ham radio social mission could be, and it is. As I said, in other countries, not necessarily a war, but just a disaster, a flood, an earthquake, an hurricane, hams can help, and they do help. So that's another second thing which excites me. So innovation first, social mission, social site second.
Linus, what advice would you give to new or returning hams to the hobby? We have a lot of hams that disappear for 10, 20, 30 years and then come back to ham radio. What advice would you give to those people?
My advice would be just, you know, go ahead. Don't be shy. You know, nothing's lost. If you left your tube type transceiver 30 years ago, take it out of your closet, switch it on, listen to the air, get to a local club, you know, talk to other hams, say openly that I'm a, you know, return ham. What's going on, guys? Tell me. You know, hams on the local frequencies, you know, in every country you have local frequencies on 80 meters where you can, you know, talk about life, dogs, your gardening things, whatever. That's fine. I take part in one of these, I must confess. I like it, talk to, you know. So do this, say, I returned, what's going on with equipment? What's going on with antennas? Tell me, guys. You will get, you know, go to Facebook, you know, the technologies merge, you know, go to Facebook if you have one, I'm sure you do, and say, you know, find a group of the ham radio, you know, operators, say, I'm return ham, you know, what do you do nowadays, you know, I've been living under a rock for the last 40 years, I want to get out. So you will get a helping hand. You will get an advice, which equipment to buy, where to go. No problems. And for a new hams, I don't know, they don't need an advice. If they are young and they got bitten by this bug, okay, stay in the hobby. Save your money for the better equipment, or not necessarily, you know. Choose the area which is most close to your heart, because ham radio hobby is so wide scaled hobby that, you know, you can be everything. You can be a hunter, you can be a fox, you can be a expeditioner, you can be a traveler, you can be a linguist, you can be a nature lover. What else you can be? You can be a constructor. You can be a social worker, you know, by your social activities. Well, you can be anything. Just choose what you want. Ham radio is the most intellectual hobby in the world. And that would be my advice. Just, you know, if you got, you know, if you learned from somewhere about this wonderful hobby, go deep into it. Read a lot, because, you know, you need to have some qualification. It's a technical hobby. You know, you need to, you can get killed by the high voltage or even not so high voltage, you know. Get educated yourself, you know. But, well, don't be afraid by the exams, you know, of this license. No problems. Exams are good for you. You need exams because you get educated. You're getting educated by learning things. You know, you are forced to learn some formulas, you know, some basics in physics and, you know, in electronics. This is good for you. you educate yourself. So as I did and you did. So that's, don't be afraid of this side. That's necessarily thing just to pass, and very many people passing. And finally, get back to Morse code. Many people start learning it. And you, if you are a new ham, just make a promise, you know, to yourself, kind of a New Year promise that, you know, I will learn a Morse code. Why? Because you can and because it's fun. No more reasons, no more any other reasons anymore why you should learn Morse, apart that this is fun, and it is.
Linus, I want to thank you so much for joining me on the QSO Today podcast. Frankly, I really enjoyed getting to know you first from your YouTube channel and doing the research before the interview. And I enjoyed so much having this conversation with you on QSO Today. In terms of your advice, the only thing that you left out was new and returning ham should go to your YouTube channel in order to learn some of the things that interest you the most, which I'm sure will interest a lot of people. So with that, I want to thank you so much and wish you 73.
Eric, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for doing your great job in promoting ham radio, in doing these podcasts. This is very, very important, and for me it was just, I was very, very glad, you know, to have a chat, a talk between our friends. I didn't know you before, but now I know you, and so it's always, ham radio is about solidarity and about friends talking to friends. Thank you very much.
73. That concludes this QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed this QSO with Linus. Please be sure to check out the show notes that include links and information about the topics that we discussed. Go to www.qsotoday.com and put an LY2H in the search box at the top of the page. You may notice that some episodes are transcribed into written text. If you'd like to sponsor this or any of the episodes into written text, push the Sponsor Transcription button in the center of every show notes page. Support the QSO Today podcast by first joining the QSO Today email list by pressing the subscribe buttons on the show notes pages. I will not spam you or share your email address with anyone. Become a listener sponsor monthly or annually by clicking on the sponsor buttons on the show notes pages. Your value for value support is recognized on the QSO Today podcast and in the weekly show notes. If listener sponsorship is not for you, then please use our Amazon link when you shop on Amazon. Clicking on this link before you enter Amazon will allow Amazon to pay us a small commission on everything you purchase. This is a very painless way to support the QSO Today podcast, and it costs you nothing. QSO Today is syndicated on every podcast platform by using Podcast Index. Use the latest Podcast 2.0 player on your smartphone to automatically get to your podcast updates as soon as we publish. I'm now using Podverse to track, manage, and listen to my podcasts. Positive comments about QSO Today on social media is appreciated as it helps to grow our listener base. My thanks to Ben Bresky, who makes this podcaster and guests sound brilliant. Thanks, Ben. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73. The QSO Today podcast is a product of KEG Media, Inc., who is solely responsible for its content.